Welcome along to the Go Play Soccer podcast with host Manchester United Academy coach Tom Statham. At Go Play, our aim is to bring people together from all across the world to discuss the beautiful game.
Tom Statham here, and today on the Go Play Soccer podcast, we're talking with Rick Fanolio. Rick has recently retired from a 30-year academic career in sports science at the Manchester Metropolitan University. It was almost 20 years ago that Rick and I worked together on a research project involving MMU and Manchester United. This project has been recognised worldwide as the catalyst for change in how many countries incorporate small-sided games into their coaching and games programmes for young players today. Joining us as well is Seamus Beaglehole. Seamus coaches in the foundation phase with the under-10s at Leicester City. So welcome, Rick. Welcome, Seamus.
Welcome. Great to be here.
Thanks, Tom. Thanks for the invite.
You're very welcome. So, Rick, we're going to go right back to the beginning of this story, 1998, and you were approached by Brian Kidd, who at the time was the assistant manager of the first team at Manchester United.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, this is interesting. This is a bit of a trip down memory lane for us, but also it's looking for those people out there listening that are, you know, love the game and love the history of the game. This is quite an insightful history of kind of where small-sided games evolved from into the mainstream in English-speaking countries. And of course, if you go back, you know, small-sided games certainly didn't, you know, originate in the UK or in America or whatever. You know, obviously Rinus Michels and the Dutch sides of the 70s and 80s, you know, they kind of popularized 4v4 through their concept of the Dutch vision. So it's not new, but I think what the Man United scheme and a bit of the research that I and my team ended up doing, you know, kind of gave a undercurrent or a stable base to the what people thought was an obvious way of improving footballers, young footballers, is, you know, through small-sided games and stuff. So the research was kind of the first of its kind. It wasn't difficult, but let's go back to 1998. Brian Kidd, before he left Manchester United, made a visit to our department, the Department of Sports Sciences at Manchester Met. Because sports science was just now kind of starting to creep into professional football. Roy Hodgson had coached abroad and brought back some ideas and some different, you know, fitness trainers and stuff. Sam Allardyce at Bolton, you know, was doing some really revolutionary stuff with the backroom staff at that club. So Brian Kidd was kind of asking questions about what sports science could do for Man United. And we put together a proposal, which was ultimately turned down initially, but it set the stimulus for me. It kind of gave me another lifetime goal. I want to work for Manchester United, you know, one of those things. I'd always been a fan. And, you know, when I saw Brian Kidd in front of our secretary's desk, I just absolutely just stopped in my tracks and made some decisions that night. This is what I wanted to do. So being kind of a rebel, arrogant American, I sent the academy director at the time, Les Kershaw, a list of 100 sports science ideas for the Manchester United Academy. So everything I'd picked up from working in other sports, and I'd done some work with some of the smaller clubs, Bury and Port Vale. And so I just made a list and I just sent it to him. Not thinking I would get a response. It was just one of those cheeky things to do, basically. About 2 weeks later, he asked Tony Whelan, who has become a, you know, great friend, and we've worked together, and I love him to bits. He's just a fantastic person for many reasons. But he called me up and said, I've seen your list. Les has passed it to me. And what I'd like you to do is come into the club, come down to Carrington, and we'll talk about some of the projects. So the first project we ended up doing together was putting together a library of coaching manuals, coaching books for players and the coaching staff at Carrington. So we finished that, and then I kind of went back to my university life for a year or two. And then finally I got another phone call from Tony saying, We've got a project running here, a small-sided games project, and we would like somebody to come and validate and study it. And so, of course, I said yes. And Tom, you can probably come pick up the story from here, because there's a little bit of a backlog about how the origins of the program started. Because I'd been telling people that, because I've done a couple of these for American audiences, and my story was that the club had done some tournaments in Spain and France and noticed the technical abilities of the continental players, and then came back to Carrington and basically tore up the playbook. But you can probably put me straight for what I'm going to tell people in the future. So over to you.
I was working at the time with the under 12, under 13 age groups at United. And in 2002, Paul McGuinness, who was in charge at the time of under 9s to under 16s, asked me to have a chat. So we had a little wander around the training ground, and he basically explained that they weren't happy with the program with the youngest players, not under 9s, 10s and 11s. And like you say, Rick, that the technique of our young players wasn't up to some of the teams that we were playing against in tournaments on the continent. And they wanted to put in a program that would address that, really. And Tony Whelan, who you've mentioned, who we did ask to come on this podcast, but he politely declined for lack of technological understanding, really. but unfortunately, you know, Tony would be great to fill bits in here, but we'll play on without him. But Paul said that Tony was going to concentrate on this program with especially the under nines and tens, and we were going to bring in a specialist skills coach and a guy called Renny Muhlenstein, who had been working with Curva in the Middle East. So he wanted me to join Rene and join Tony to develop this new program for the under nines and tens, especially. So I said, sounds great. So I jumped at the chance. You know, obviously knew Tony really well since I've been working at the club since 1994, and Tony even before that. So I was already, you know, good friends with Tony. And so the opportunity to work with him and Rennie coming in was just, you know, really exciting for me. So that first season that we did, 2002-03, that was a combination in training of a lot of Curva style coaching. So Rennie would lead that. And then on a Sunday, we played 8v8, because at the time, after Howard Wilkinson had brought out the Charter for Excellence in 1997 with Academy Football, under 9s, under 10s and under 11s all played 8v8. That was a standard. You didn't play anything else apart from 8v8 every week. And then at under 12,
you weren't allowed to play anything else, were you? You weren't allowed to play anything else.
No, you couldn't. It was every Sunday for the games programs, 8v8. Under 9s, under 10s, under 11s, and then under 12s, you went to 11 aside. And this was an area that we felt wasn't right. But for that first season, I was involved with the foundation phase kids. With the under 9s, we played 8v8 every week. And then in 2003, I believe that's when you came on board, Rick.
So, yeah, I came in when the pilot scheme was just kicking off, just starting. And when I first saw the pilot scheme in action, again, small-sided games, nothing really new about 4v4. But some of the other qualities of that program, you know, I kind of clocked and I recorded. So some of the things that you guys did, which was very unique at the time, was basically there was no set program. So it wasn't just 8v8. It was adaptable. Yeah. So say Newcastle came to Littleton Road and they had 60 players, you could just, you know, add another pitch. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think that's right. Yeah.
So it was really adaptable. You didn't hold scores, right? So there's no tallying of scores.
No league or anything like that. No.
Yeah. So I'm sure the players knew the score. You know, that's just what they do as players. So the duration of the games was what? It was 8 minutes or something like that. Small duration games, but many of them.
Yeah. So we generally played about 8 minute games. You're right. Yeah. So then we'd rotate them round. And we had, so we went from this program from the 2002-03 season that was all 8v8. We went certainly for the under nines. This is the project for the under nines. We went to this 4v4 situation. And in that pre-season of 2003, then one of my great memories is Tony and I were basically, well, how big are these pitches going to be? Because we decided there were going to be four different styles of games. One was line ball, where you scored a goal if you dribbled the ball over the line. One was a four-goal game where you had two goals in each corner. So you attacked and switching play was obviously the emphasis there. One game was with a goal and goalkeepers in there, which Tony didn't want to do. He didn't want goals there. And I said, look, you've got to have goals there. The kids want to play in goals.
Well, the other thing I noticed about the setup was that the parents would certainly just go around that goal game.
Yeah,
you know, they wouldn't go to the other games. They would sit and watch the goals fly in, which is fair enough.
And then the fourth type of game was we just used to use some big traffic cones and have a small, it was about a meter and a half wide goal with no goalkeepers. And so those were the four games. And we didn't know the size of the pitches. So that summer of 2003, the very first time that we were looking to do it, we went with the groundsman and we were just pacing it out saying, well, I think this will be the right size pitch and so on. And the groundsman all marked it out. And the first time we ever did it was against Blackpool. And they came down in August, pre-season of 2003. And the guy that arrived with this group of kids from Blackpool, I really remember it because he wore John Lennon sort of circular glasses. And he turned up and he was there for an 8v8. He knew nothing apart from we were going to play an 8v8. And he had about 17, 18 lads, and he expected two games of 8v8. So Tony and I said, no, you're playing 4v4. No, this is what we're doing. And he had no idea what was going on. So I said to him, look, all you do is you pick teams of four. So split your kids up into teams of four, and then we'll sort the rest. I explained the different games. We'll sort the rest. We've got one game of line ball, one game of four-goal game, one game with cones for goals, and one game with goalkeepers. That's it. And
revolutionary, man.
Oh, well, but it was like I was talking a different language to him. He was so confused by it all, that the fact that we weren't just playing a couple of 8v8s. And he looked at me and then he looked at Tony and he just said to Tony, he's blinding me with science, like this. And so Tony stared at him. He grabbed him by the upper arm and he dragged him down this corridor and pushed him into the kitchen area, right? And I was following behind. And Tony, like, got him up against the wall and just said, listen to me. This is what we're doing. Get 14, get these teams, four lads. We got these games, blah, blah, blah. I got these games. And was like an inch away, spitting in his face. And this fella looked so scared. And so he went off and he got his team sorted and we just ran it. And that was the first experience. But the resistance to that was incredible because everyone just thought 8v8 was what it was. That's all you played. So yeah, I mean, any sort of change was really
really strange. radical. Absolutely. I mean now it seems so tame. So as part of the research, which I can go into in a second, you know, I interviewed coaches about it, I interviewed parents and stuff, and the most resistance came from the parents because it was like, oh, we've come all the way up to Man United and we get to shoot through cones. I mean, that's just not Man United style, you know. We expected, well, they expected an FA Cup final every week, but you know, that's another story. So there were no referees in this game.
No refs. So each game, and that was the beauty of it for me, was that the kids just looked after it themselves. The coaches were there, so we generally had a coach that was observing each pitch. So we would maybe say to the opposition coaches, "Look, why don't you have a look at that game?" But again, a lot of the opposition coaches, they gravitated towards the game with the goals in. Rather than, you know, no one wanted to watch the line ball really, but that was probably one of the best games, the line ball, because it was loads of dribbling and taking players on and loads of skill. So, you know, our staff tended to look after that. But again, it was really difficult from the point of view of a lot of the older coaches. I remember we played, I think it was Coventry City were involved, and there was a guy that was an older coach. And I just centrally time it. So I'd start off, right, everyone go. And then, like you said, 8 minute games. And then I'd blow the whistle and all the kids would come back to their cones. Each team would have a cone where they'd have the drinks and then we'd have the drinks. Well, we sent them out for the first games. I'd say, right, Manchester United team one, you're playing line ball against Coventry City team two or whatever. And we'd send them all out.
Yeah.
And then we'd get going. And there was this one coach that the game was over a minute old. and they hadn't started to play. And he was just tactically drilling them on how to play this game and talking to them. And it was, come on, we've got to get started. And they just couldn't, even though it was a 4v4 game, a four goal game, then he couldn't get away from the fact that he had to tell the kids exactly what to do.
Yeah, this is a major development that this program really kicked off around the world. And it's kind of come to fruition through constraints-led approaches about letting the kids play. And, you know, through my work in Give Us Back Our Game, which we can talk about later, I encountered that, you know, across the United States, still in the UK, that, you know, coaches, they didn't want to let go of control of the game. And, you know, Tony was always saying, let the kids play. And you as well, you really hammered that home. Let the kids play. Let the game be the teacher. We don't want to tell them what to do on the pitch because we want them to learn it for themselves. And this, you know, the science is kind of developed around this because constraints-led theories, you know, were just starting when the pilot scheme was going. But that added some scientific basis to what you guys had done, you know, generically. And I just,
yeah, and Tony
brought the whole thing came together at the right time.
And Tony brought in his stool and we all had these little stools that we had. So again, that was a factor to try and encourage people just to not get involved. So most of our coaches, we used to sit on a little stool like gnomes, you know, with a fishing rod. So we just sit on these stools again, because the body language is really important. And we just sat together and had a laugh, really. And that was the key. And I'm still following the same sort of principles today. You know, I'm very aware of my body language. I'm very aware that on the sideline, when the kids look over, I want them to see me enjoying it and relax so that it passes over these positive messages. I mean,
especially at that age group. And it's been a worldwide, I don't want to say conflict, but it's been a worldwide development toward this type of approach, and it's not absolutely widespread. I mean, I go to the States a lot. I see a lot of players standing around waiting in lines for drills, et cetera, et cetera. And man, if they're not moving, they ain't learning. So, you know, it's just get them playing and let the game do its job. You know, coaches should use the game to benefit the players, you know.
And the other thing Tony was really keen on was no subs or very few subs. So obviously the games are 4v4. So if you had 17 players, then one of the teams would have a sub. But again, the kids sorted out that, you know, the guy on the side was told to count to 60. And when he counts to 60, then he brought himself into the game. And the kids just naturally then rotated the substitute. So the coaches had, well, the only role that we had was to make sure that the kids were safe, make sure they were happy.
Yeah.
If there was any sort of injuries, there might have been a little kick or something like that, just to make sure that they're okay. But other than that, just completely leave them to it.
And again, this philosophy has traveled around the globe into different levels of football. And of course, you know, when you put Manchester United on something, a name, it spreads. So I did the research. The research itself was pretty straightforward in terms of scientific principles. We took our cameras down to Littleton Road and filmed both 8v8 matches and 4v4 matches. Tony used to call me Steven Spielberg when he'd see me with the camera and stuff like that. And then it was basically taking the videos back to the university and counting, you know, counting the number of shots, counting the number of dribbles, 1v1 situations, etc. And the results were obvious, but it was people believe numbers, people like numbers. So while everybody knew that we were going to find out more passes were done in the 4v4, having quantifiable data is very powerful. So we took the videos out. We went back to the university, counted up the different parameters, and basically we found, of course, that during academy fixtures, as compared to similar 8v8 game segments, the 4v4 games on average increased the number of passes by 135%, the number of scoring attempts by 260%, the number of goals scored by 500%, the number of one-on-one encounters by 225%, and the number of dribbling skills or tricks demonstrated by the players rose by 280%. So you know, in terms of for those players, they were getting, you know, many, you know, 100 times more passes, scoring attempts, etc. So we published this in Insight, which at the time was the FA coach's manual. And that, of course, people read that worldwide. And that kind of led to me being involved in the Give Us Back Our Game program, which basically took the ethos and the philosophy and the small-sided games approach and the, you know, let the players play into the grassroots of the UK. And so it started bubbling there. We were an advocate for small-sided games, for better formats for kids, for, you know, not against the adult-led adultification of football, etc. So we made a bit of a nuisance of ourselves for 2 or 3 years, had a lot of interviews and stuff. 10 years later, the FA listened. We had a couple of frosty meetings with them, but they took it on board. And over the next 7 or 8 years, they did their roadshow where Nick Levitt, basically, who was the FA skills coach, kind of became the advocate for this type of approach. And in the end,
what was the opposition? You know, you came up with some great figures there that it's so blatantly obvious. Yeah. You're backing it up with data that certainly for very young kids, 8, 9 year old kids, they're getting so much more out of these small sided games. The facts are in front of them. But what was the opposition that people were still mounting against this form of small sided game?
Yeah, just traditional way of thinking, hierarchies in clubs, hierarchies in leagues, hierarchies in the associations. So I think you probably had a similar experience where I went down to an academy coaches meeting with Tony to discuss the program, discuss the findings, and see what we could make of it and stuff. And literally you went around the room and, you know, a lot of the academy coaches simply thought it was a way for Manchester United to scout and recruit more players. Because if you're having more players play, then it's obvious that the other academies are going to be pretty skeptical of this. And at the time, there was no, 1 hour traveling distance for scouting. So the other academies were very, very, you know, skeptical that it wasn't just a Manchester United ploy to get more players.
We heard that a lot, that people were really suspicious, were anti it because they thought we were just trying to nick all their best players, which was absolutely ludicrous because we just wanted our players to get the best possible experience.
Yeah.
And I remember Tony and I went down to Watford where Nick Cox, who's now the academy manager at Manchester United, Nick was involved at Watford. And we went down and there was a guy with him, Dave Godley was involved at Watford as well, working with Nick. And Dave was the guy that they were trying to get this going in the Southern clubs. And I remember Dave Godley said that he'd phoned up another Premier League team and said, we want to do 4v4 with our under nines this weekend. And the guy on the other end of the phone said, well, we haven't got enough players. And so Dave said to him, how many have you got? 3. Which was a fantastic reply. But there was just that resistance. And then,
it's almost like until you put it in practice and people can see it for what it is, they didn't really get it. They needed to see it. But then
we did that, Rick. We did, you know, we went down, we did this. Birmingham City hosted an event where we put on a big festival with Birmingham City and Manchester United. I think there might have been a Southern club in that as well, where we did a big festival, 3 clubs, loads of games going on. So there's about 12 different pitches, just football all over the place, kids having a great time, 4v4 everywhere, all the different games, line ball, 4-goal game, cone game, and goalkeeper game. And it was sensational. It was a beautiful day. I can remember it was a great setting at Birmingham. And then at the end of it, we almost had a press conference situation where there was Rene, Tony, and myself was sat behind this big desk in the press room at Birmingham City's training ground. And there was about 30 or 40 of the Southern-based academy coaches in the room, and they were free to ask questions of us. And I could just remember a guy from a big Premier League club then saying, well, shall I do the accent, Rick?
Yeah, do it. Yeah, do it. Good. This is a Southern accent. Are you Southern American accent? This is a Southern.
So this bloke from a big London club said, "Well, it's all very well. this, Tom. On a Sunday, I like to drive into the training ground. I like to go to the canteen, get myself a cup of tea, wander out onto the field and see the under nines play a proper game of football. And it was like,
that was very good, by the way.
So, sorry?
That was very good, by the way.
Was it good? Oh, thank you.
And no, not really. But
so I was like, but so the under nines then basically are a form of entertainment for you. You know, it's what you want on a Sunday. You want to see Manchester United play Liverpool or, you know, whoever it is. You don't want what's best for the kids. You want to put on a spectacle for the coaches and the parents. And that's completely the wrong attitude.
That's it. It's a real paradigm shift for coaches out there to think about how the kids see the game. What's their experience on a Saturday or Sunday? It's a hard shift to make because of the way football has been, you know, especially in the UK and the US. You know, it's parent driven. It's adult driven. So to try to get to put yourself in the eyes of the child that you're coaching, you know, it takes some doing. It takes, you have to give up a lot of ego, basically.
But I'll tell you what, Rick, let's pause for a second and give Seamus a chance.
Sorry, mate.
Yeah.
Seamus has sat there very patiently while we've been
Listening very intently, and some really interesting points raised. And that you've just said there, Tom, strikes me as the coach thinking about himself rather than the players. You know, he wants to go out there and enjoy watching what he perceives as a proper game of football. It sounded very much like Harry Redknapp, by the way. I hope it wasn't him. That was
it wasn't Harry Redknapp.
And I've sort of often found that is that the coaches would prefer to do a 7v7 rather than a 4v4 because they actually enjoy more of the tactical element of coaching, and they like to try and set a team up in a 2-3-1 and work on, you know, maybe a high press or something like that. So really it's for them rather than thinking what will benefit the players the most. I remember at a previous club the under 12s were playing 1 11v11, but then they'd have about 5 or 6 subs. And I was taking the foundation phase at the time, and I was saying, you know, why don't you play 2 9v9s or 2 8v8s at 12s and bump a few 11s up if you need be. No, I'm going to stick with the 11v11. And because he was in charge of the YDP phase, I couldn't do anything about it, but that was his decision. And the only reason I could think he was doing that, because it was less hassle sorting kit out and getting more kit for the other boys. And obviously he likes to stand on the sideline and watch 11v11 game. I think this is where we need to get better in this country and, you know, take our ego out of it as well, of trying to set a team up to play Man United and try and beat Man United. Because it sounds like Man United have that a lot, where they get oppositions coming to them, you know, and it's Man United and it's a big occasion for them. I remember when I was at...
I agree, Seamus. It's the mentality of the coach. You've got to understand that you're doing this for the kids. You're not doing this for yourself. And as Rick said earlier, you've got to get into the mind of a young child. And that's something that I've really... I think I've almost perfected it now, because I do try and think of myself as like an 8-9-year-old. So, you know, when we had our games, we played each other, like Leicester played Manchester United a couple of weeks ago. But even at training sessions, though, like tonight, I'll be going into training. And as the kids arrive, I need to connect with them as, a young child. Because if I connect with them as a 53-year-old bald guy, then I'm going to have no relationship with them whatsoever. And I can't expect them to become, you know, middle-aged men. So I've got to go down and I've got to interact with them like a kid. So I've got to be silly, and I've said this before, you know, tell jokes and be silly and sing little songs and make them feel happy and give them high fives and, you know, all these sort of things to make them feel settled and make them feel comfortable. And that's so important, rather than being the football coach that knows everything, that wants to, like you say, play a formation and teach them adult football. Little kids can't access adult football. Little kids need little kids football.
It's really a shift. If I can just jump in here for a second, it's really a shift from emphasis on coaching or what you do as a coach and learning. Okay, we got to get away from, you know, coaching and really emphasize how the kids learn, what they're learning, what environment are they learning in. That to me, that's a seismic shift. And I think we're going to see more of that in the next decade. I hope so anyway. A shift toward concentrating on learning. Seamus, what do you think?
No, I agree. I think foundation phase players know a lot sometimes before they leave the foundation phase. They're often coached quite an awful lot of detail around the tactics, football. And when they get to 14s, 15s, 16s, it can become quite boring, I guess, you know, for a young player to hear the same messages, you know, about maybe making an overlapping run or arcing your run as you press or being compact and defending in a shape. So I think how the kids learn and when they learn different elements is really important. Like I say, I think the kids should be just enjoying themselves when they arrive and shouldn't be worrying about flipping it. What's my individual learning plan for this week or for this mesocycle, whatever you're
like
working
on? I said earlier, Seamus, a couple of weeks ago, we came down to Leicester and played your guys at under 10s. And how would you describe the atmosphere that between us we created for those? We played six aside.
Yeah.
Great format. How would you describe the environment that we created?
Yeah, well, so firstly, 6v6, we play 3 6v6 games. For us at Leicester, we know we always play 7v7s when we play away. So we always try to play a smaller format and try and play three games at home when we can because it gets more bodies on the pitch. You guys were really sort of relaxed with the players, stood on the side of the bank, you know, having loads of laughs and jokes with them, rotated an outfield player who played in goal. And the kids just, you know, fed off that. They seemed really relaxed in the game. There was lots of dribblers in Man United's side. I thought their best player.
Yeah, and that causes problems because if you dribble the ball really close to your own goal and get tackled, the opposition score. So you have to get rid of that element of you that says that's wrong.
Yeah.
Because it's not first team. If the first team do that, then they get slaughtered for it. Whereas if a 9-year-old kid does it, it's not a problem. You're right, we spent most of the time laughing at the kids. You know, we put the outfield players in goal and they were brilliant in goal. And they pulled off some ridiculously good saves and they pulled off some ridiculously bad attempts at stopping it. And we just laughed with them because what do you do? What else can you do apart from enjoy the moments? But I'm pleased that you pointed out about the dribbling because that's what our kids do. They, whenever they get the ball, no matter where they're on the pitch, they just dribble.
Yeah. I think the goalkeeper even came out and headed it at one point. Yeah. We got a laugh at, you know, we was all laughing at that. And I picked out Man United's best player. It was a small lad called Toby, very slight, but a fantastic dribbler and mover with the ball. And he scored a great goal, you know. And if he's taken anything away from that particular day, it's that one magic moment that is set in everyone's mind. I remember it, you know, the other players on the pitch will probably remember it. And we're looking for those kind of magic moments that you only get from allowing the players to be creative, not telling them how to play. You're not restricting them anyway.
Yeah.
Just allowing them to be free.
And you say about telling them how to play, Seamus, because all our kids were dribbling, but I've never said to our kids that you must dribble. Never said that.
Yeah.
But what I don't say is that you can't dribble. What I don't say is you must pass it. And that's what I see a lot of other coaches do, is that they're constantly saying, pass it, give it, release it, get rid. All these sort of things. Whereas we never say that to kids. We don't put those restrictions on them at all. Everything's possible. You know, this weekend, one of the kids scored an amazing goal, like an overhead kick. The ball was played about 25 yards in the air and he did a big scissor kick and it went in. It was an amazing goal. Now, you're never going to see that if the kids think that they're going to get told off for trying or experimenting. So it's more about not what you tell the kids to do. It's not telling them that they can't do things.
Can I ask you guys a question?
Sure.
Right. The question is, I know we're talking about games, sessions, but in training, what percentage would you say that your coaches put to small-sided games or constrained games or adapted games or whatever, and how much do they go revert back to what we might call traditional coaching, stop, stand still, or individual technique work or whatever? What's your percentages? That's a question for you.
Very high, I think. Very high in favor of small sided games.
And, okay.
You know, games maybe with constraints. It might be I like to do a game where it might be one touch or four touch. So I only drop that in every so often just to to see if players are seeing pictures and can play off one touch, but then you're not actually saying you can't dribble. But in terms of unopposed practices and technical practices, you might do it as a bit of an activator at the start of the session, 15 minutes, boom, really, you know, quick in and out. Doesn't go on for too long because I feel the players don't get fully engaged in that. I think they find it quite mundane and boring.
What, in the small sort of games?
No, the unopposed practices.
Oh, the unopposed. Okay.
Yeah, so we don't do much of it because I feel, like you said about the 4v4 study, you know, the passes were up 135%, I think it was.
Yeah.
So you're getting a lot of passes in a 4v4 game.
Exactly.
So you don't really need to work on a play to this player who stood at this mannequin and then he's going to play there.
Yeah.
You can put them in a game environment and still get plenty of repetitions.
Definitely.
Of passes. Okay. So we don't really do much unopposed at all, to be fair. We might do 15 minutes, usually cap it at that time length because I feel you start to lose the attention span of the players.
Yeah. Tom, what about Man U?
Yeah, with the under nines and tens, especially where I'm working, is that we do virtually all our coaching is in small-sided games. Or, for example, the other day we did crossing and finishing, but we did it as a game. So we had Team A playing Team B while Team C was doing the crossing. And as soon as the first goal went in, then the winning team stayed on and the crossing team came off and it was just constantly changing. So it's even when we're just doing a crossing and finishing practice, it's very competitive and it's set up as a game. So the vast majority of our practices are games. And even now, over the Easter period, we had them in all day. So you can't be intense playing games all day. You know, they need a breather every now and then. So we did do a bit of individual work, but that is more. I did a session inside where we're just doing different games really against the wall. So different challenges. How many times can you volley at this particular thing? Or how many times can you play left foot, right foot against the wall, or bits of juggling? And that's really to give them an idea of what they should be doing at home. So this is what this is to inspire them. So when they're with us, it's vast majority of their time is in small sided games. Like we did last week as well, we did a 2v2 tournament that was fantastic. And so we do, you know, 1v1s, 2v2s, all the way up to, you know, we do play like 12-a-side at times, but we'll often have like 3-4 balls in. So we play everything from 1v1 up to 12v12, different sorts of games, different constraints, as you'd put it. And yeah, it's just exciting. Again, it's giving the kids what they want as well. You know, so I think that's an important thing is give the kids what they want to do. And young kids, they want to dribble, they want to shoot, they want to score goals, they want to be with their mates, they want to have a good time. And, you know, they just want to have fun.
Okay. And how do you communicate to a player who you see is doing something repeatedly incorrect, if there is such an incorrect at this age group? But how do you pull the player and have a chat and then put them back in, or do you do it after training or what?
Again, because there are not many things that you can do that's wrong, really. So don't do that often. It's more, I will pull kids, you know, to just congratulate them or give them a small bit of feedback, but it's mostly just really positive feedback. Oh, I saw that goal. Oh, you scored a great goal there. Or, you know, when you're tying the shoelaces, possibly then have a little chat to them. But like I said before, the key is to not say, don't do this, don't do that.
And yeah.
So there's very little information like that I give at all. It's all about, you know, how you doing? Oh, that was great. I saw you make a great tackle. Oh, you cleared that one off the line. Or, you know, what a great save that was for the goalie. You know, it's really, all the communication is really, really positive, and it's all upbeat and it's all, you know, aimed at making the kids enjoy themselves and relax and have fun, really. You know, I'm like Coco the Clown. It's like, it's really not more, I'm more kids entertainer than coaching that way. It's not much technical ability. Now, the technical side of it comes before the session. So the football knowledge comes before the session when you're designing the practice, you're designing the games.
Yeah.
So in the planning, that's where your football expertise comes in and your football experience comes in. But once the session started, then, you know, you're there just to be there with the kids and reassure, and make them feel great? And how do most people make, most people feel great when they're encouraged and you make them laugh? People feel great when you make them laugh.
So the real, I guess, you, can I sum up by saying, but the real work for coaches is to design adaptive games or creative games that that work on the technical abilities that you want to see in gameplay. So the real intelligent work for a coach is in the planning stage of what happens in that training. Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And then your experience comes in as if you're not getting it right. So like the crossing and finishing game that we did the other day, you know, it worked great and the kids were loving it, but maybe it didn't, you know, it doesn't always go well. And then it's recognizing it doesn't go well. And then how can you tinker with it? How can you make a few adjustments to make it a better game?
Yeah. Seamus, same.
Yeah, I mean, you'd step in as a coach if you saw a young player visibly upset maybe about a mistake. So like right. We spoke about dribblers, maybe dribbling in front of their own goal, and it might lead to them conceding from it if he gets intercepted and they finish from it. And then it's how do you to build them up after that. Sometimes the player might be all right. You can see it, you know, he's all right, he's disappointed, but then he gets back into the game and it's forgotten about. Other boys might or girls might be different. You might have to just support them a little bit more. I also feel sometimes coaches have an idea of how they think the game should look and should be played and are quite quick to jump in there to try and coach that player to get him to play in a way that they want them to play, when really maybe you should be a little bit more patient with them to see if they can figure it out themselves. Yeah. I think sometimes as coaches, they try to solve the problems for the players without actually allowing them to have a chance to, you know, to have a go at themselves.
And fail and learn from failure, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I think that's a big learner, isn't it? Obviously. And,
definitely.
And also learning through struggle sometimes. Sometimes you have to struggle at a certain aspect to come through the other side and have learned from that experience.
Great.
Yeah, I'd say regulate the job of the coach, certainly working with young players, but really working with any age players, is not to solve the puzzle. It's very tempting, like Seamus said, that football is a puzzle and you want your team to do well. You want the kids to do well because they're a reflection of you. So you want your sessions to look beautiful and well-organized and clean and they want them to work. So you set the sessions up where the kids will be successful, really, to reflect well on yourself. But that's not going to improve them. And so your job is to set the puzzle as opposed to solve the puzzle. And that's where I get back to the planning of it. It's your job to set the appropriate challenge, set the puzzle that then the kids can work out for themselves. It may be scruffy. It may be chaotic. It may be untidy. You know, someone may look at it and think it's completely disorganized, but it's not. And that's where you've got to have the confidence and the bravery as a coach to back yourself. And that's where being at a club like Manchester United that's been very stable and working with a lot of people over a long period of time gives you that stability, that confidence, and that you can say, no, I'm doing this for the right reasons. And the why you're doing it. I'm doing it for the kids because this is the right thing to do at this stage of their learning. This is the right thing to do. And that's why I'm doing it, you know, through my experience.
How do you create a club culture like that? Now, I know we, you know, Tony Whelan is a very strong character, believes in it wholly. All the coaches of the younger age groups at United believe the ethos, correct? Yeah?
Yeah, it comes down to leadership, doesn't it? Every culture comes down to leadership, because if the people at the top are undermining, you know, so if I believed what we're talking about now, but the people above me were constantly undermining that, I wouldn't be able to do it. So I wouldn't be working there because I'd either have to compromise my principles, you know, or find somewhere else to be. And I'd choose the latter. So it's all about leadership and support. Just like it's my role to be the leader of those little kids and to show them what I want them to do and then support them. Like Seamus said, if a kid's upset or injured or whatever, is to support them. Then I need the same. So as a coach, I need the people above me to support me. And ideally, oh, that was great what we did the other day. And, you know, it was fantastic. So give you that feedback and give you the encouragement to keep going.
Yeah, I was just thinking about club culture and transition and changing the way coaches view training and the environment and all those other things. I mean, Seamus, what's it like at Leicester? Is everybody singing the same page?
Yeah, I mean, on this podcast, Rich Keeling's been on, and I think me and Rich are obviously of the same thinking. I think Rich is great. He's a great man manager, not just for us as staff, but also the kids. Each kid he speaks, he interacts with really well. He understands what we're like as coaches. He gives us a lot of freedom to go and coach. We have a set way of how we want to develop players, of course, you know, from the head of coaching and from the academy manager. But that's what I really like about Leicester. You're allowed to sort of coach in a way that, you know, is sort of natural to you, really. With us all working in line of, we want to develop players without telling them everything. We want them to be free. We want it to look like kids' football at the foundation phase. I think sometimes some other clubs are quite keen for it to look like an adult game, yeah, almost. It's very structured. For us, we're quite different, but we believe in the way we develop players, and it seems to work for us in the past. We've got players into the first team, and I guess that's what you could sort of judge yourselves on. And we're always talking about the players that have come through and what it looked like for them at the different age groups.
Yeah. You've almost got as many players in your first team as we've got in your first team.
we've had quite a few from Man United. Yeah,
exactly. Right. But I'm joking. But that's the point of this thing of a race to 11 aside, a race to the adult game. Everyone thinks that the adult game, you know, it has to be brought in early. And I always think of like learning to drive. So when you're 16 or 17 years old, most kids will start to learn to drive, right? So you'd be driving a car on the road, and that's a massive responsibility. So the best thing to do, therefore, when a kid is 6, 7, 8, 9 years old, you don't put them in a full-size car on the road. You don't say, well, because they'll be driving at 16, 17, the earlier we get them in a car, the sooner they get on that road in a full-size car, the better driver they'll be when they're 16, 17, 18. That'd be ludicrous. It'd be stupid. They're not mentally, physically, emotionally. In no way is an 8-year-old, 9-year-old kid equipped to drive a car on the road. But that's what we sort of do with football. We say, well, because they're going to play 11-a-side football when they're 16, 17, then the sooner we can get those elements in, the sooner we can play adult football, the sooner, you know, we want to play 9-a-side when they're 10. We want to play 11-a-side when they're 11. The sooner we do that, the better they will be down the line. And that's just not true. It's just not true. You need to, you know, to drive a car, you can be on a scooter or on a little, you know, you adapt it, don't you? You have sort of put them into situations where you give them skills that will enable them to drive at a later age, but you don't put them into a proper car.
Yeah.
And the people making those decisions are adults, you know, generally. Right, the players don't have that much say in the decisions that are made about them and what they play and how they play it, etc. You know, most of the decisions in football, grassroots and professional, are made by adults, and there's a natural tendency.
Adults ruin kids' football. If kids are in charge of kids' football, then there's not a problem. Whereas adults ruin it, and again, that's where I believe as a coach, you've got to, you know, I try and get into that mentality of a little kid. And then you see it through their eyes, and it becomes a lot easier. And then, you know, I heard recently there's a kid that got released by Manchester United, went to another club, and now he's 15 years old. And he don't want to play anymore because of that adult pressure and the adult interference. Now, there's no way that a lad that's good at football would choose to quit the game at age 15 if he was happy and that kids are in charge. So it's that adult interference, you know, that... The making training sessions adult training sessions, making the games adult games, as opposed to giving the little kids what they want.
Tom, how do you manage parents and their expectations? Because from what I've seen from some coaches is that going back to a session maybe looking a bit chaotic and being comfortable with that and understanding that there is a lot of learning to be had in those particular sessions. I think some coaches sometimes revert to a session that might look clean and they're comfortable delivering and the players might already know. for the sake of not looking silly in front of the parents, and maybe the parents not thinking that they know what they're doing, basically. How do you manage the expectations of the parents at Manchester United?
Well, personally, there's just zero consideration with, you know, when I'm planning the session, it don't even come into my head. And I'm never trying to do anything that's going to impress the parents in that way. But to me, the parents are really valuable and they're very important on the journey for the kids. So you want them on side. So I think when we have the meetings with parents, you know, we explain why we do certain things. And I think they're on board, because when they sign for the academy, the kids, the parents are, it's explained to them that we are a bit different in our approach. We're not as structured as some of the other clubs in the Northwest that they possibly could sign for. And we are different. We have a less pressurized, more casual, probably a looser approach. So I think they're well briefed. And to our faces, then they'll certainly say that they're on board with it. Maybe behind our backs, they might want us to play a bit more proper football and a bit more tactical in that way. I don't know. But I think it's really important to keep them on side, because there are huge influences on the kids. So ideally, if the parents are on board and supporting what we do, then there's more chance of success.
I mean, I think Manchester United have a greater chance of like getting the parents on board, but, you know, and certainly the larger clubs do, just because of the name and the ethos, and et cetera. But this is an absolutely huge problem in America, with pay to play for grassroots sports and stuff like that. The coaches don't want to upset the parents, and the parents have so much control and comment about the training and stuff. It's really setting the development of the game back in the US, and I'm sure here at grassroots as well, because I've seen some, you know, equally horrendous parental behavior on the touchlines. You know, they make films about this, you know, but it's a constant problem.
But there's this perception, Rick, that if you're shouting at the kids, if you're doing these very organized, structured practices, unopposed a lot of the time, and you're shouting at the kids, then parents are happy with that.
I know.
Parents think it's great because the kids are learning.
I know.
Which is crazy. And I've done, for each summer, I go out to the States and do camps and things like that. And often the parents will drop the kids off, and then they'll hang around for the first 10, 15 minutes, and I'll have loads of cones out, and I'll shout at the kids and do these static drills. And then as soon as all the parents leave, and then, right, let's have all the games, and we do all the games.
I've spoken to so many other coaches that do exactly the same thing.
And then just
because they're paying the fees,
yeah,
you know?
Of course. And that's you know, it's just wrong. There was one I remember quite a few years ago now. I was doing a camp, and the parents turned up to pick the kids up at the end of a 2-hour session. And we were playing, we had about 40 odd kids. So we played about 12, 13 aside, three teams on one pitch, me and the other guy that was helping me, the other adult, we were in goal, and the three teams could score in either goal. And we had about four balls on the pitch, three different colored bibs. And so there were balls flying all over the place.
I can just imagine.
The parents arrived and they couldn't understand what, you know, it was pandemonium. The kids were loving it. You know, there's so many goals flying in. So much, you know, like you say about the stats with passing going on, dribbling going on, shots. You know, there was so much action. And so the, you know, teams could attack both goals. Whenever a goal went in, we'd just pick the ball out the goal and hoof it to the halfway line. And it was so much fun.
Yeah.
But the parents were complaining, what's going on here? Well, this guy from Manchester United has come to teach my kid, and this is what they're doing. But luckily, the guy that had organized the camp understood, and he explained it to the parents. And I think that's the key. If you explain it to the parents, and then they look and they see the smiles on the kids' faces, and they see all the 1v1s and the 2v1s and all the technical aspects that are involved in something like that, then they can see beyond the fact that it looks a shambles and probably appreciate the learning that's going on.
Well, this is it. It looks a shambles, but they learn in shambles. You know, football's a complex game. It's the kids are complex physiologically. They're growing, you know, they're dealing with growth and development spurts. It's a complex game. You know, and that's how kids learn, you know, put them in the game. It's contextual. Definitely.
I think in the recruitment department, they seem to think if you lose a game against a so-called local rival, that it favours them. So then if there is someone that is in distance of both clubs and they get a chance to go to either one, then the conversations might be, oh, well, we beat them the other week, so you come and join us, we've got better players. And I think in recruitment, they actually think like that a little bit.
Yeah.
So, you know, that I've heard people say, oh, make sure you play strongest against them this weekend, because don't want them getting the better of us, because they're down the road and it will help us if we get a chance at signing a kid. And you think, I don't think that's, you know, a deciding factor whether a lad's going to join us or not. Surely it's about whether he enjoys it during his trial period.
Yeah.
You know, it feels like we're the right club for him, friendly staff, friendly peers, whatever. But that's how some people think.
Yeah, absolutely. And look, we're running out of time here, guys. It's been a great conversation. But Rick, before we do finish the conversation,
yeah,
you must be so proud of this study and the effects that it's had worldwide and how it is influencing football today.
Well, I am proud. I am absolutely proud. And we've publicized it. We've talked about, I kind of went on a 5-year mission to talk about the results of the game, of the study and small-sided games, et cetera. So I can't, you know, I took it as far as I can. It's part of my philosophy. It's a part of so many other coaches' philosophy. And it's down basically to the origins from you and Paul McGuinness and Tony Whelan and Rene, you know, who came up with the idea and have stuck by it and been committed to it, even in the face of, you know, dissent, you know, because there was a lot of dissent. But yeah, we stuck to it, and I love to say that it's made a global impact, which I do think it has, you know, and I couldn't be happier, you know, absolutely couldn't be happier. And best of all, we've had some great laughs, made some great new friends, and it's just been a wonderful adventure, really.
It's been great. And is there anywhere where people can access that study?
Well, if you Google it, there might be some links to insight. There will be summaries of it on the net. Because it was part of the club, I had to sign copyright, and you know, we couldn't really release it in its entirety because it's club property. But if people want to get the gist of it, they can email me if they want. It depends on how many people are watching this.
We have an email here, so people, you know, they can email the podcast here. It's at the end. The email address is given, so that probably the best way to start.
Yeah,
that.
No, I'm happy. I'm more than happy to discuss it and the philosophy and the whole thing. If people want to get in touch, that's great.
Fantastic. Well, Rick, thank you so much for your time today, and obviously thanks. 20 years ago, it nearly is now, for the experiences that we shared and the effect that it's had on me and as I've progressed, you know, through my coaching career. And Seamus, thanks so much to you for your time today. I hope you've enjoyed it.
Pleasure. Nice to meet you, Seamus.
Yeah, pleasure to be in such great company and really enjoyed the chat. As a big Man United fan, it's great for me to hear about some of the things you're doing at the club and know it's in good hands.
Fantastic. Mm-hmm. And we look forward to, you know, the next podcast, and hopefully you'll listen to all that on the Go Play Soccer podcast. We'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening. And if you have a question or comment for us, or if you'd like to take part in one of our podcasts, please email podcast@goplaysoccer.com.